You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in our region and beyond. Today we are talking fire. It's been rainy and cool out, and we're out of fire season, at least on the Northwest Coast, so it's a little less triggering to talk about what has become a terrifying part of our reality in the American West. My guests today are no stranger to this topic, and their important work navigates the intersections between fire, culture, and history. Jason Nez is a fire archaeologist and resource advisor at the Grand Canyon National Park and a member of the Dene Nation from Coal Mine, Mesa, Arizona. Vicki Preston is a Karuk, Yurok, Paiute, and Pitt River tribal member and grew up along the Klamath River in New Orleans, California. She works with cultural resources with the Karuk Tribe of Department of Natural Resources, and her work centers around the protection of cultural places for ecosystems and community futures. Jason and Vicki, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you could be here.
Yeah, good morning.
So I want to start out by talking a little bit about, more general, the role of archaeologists in big fire. So we've talked about this a little bit on the show, but I think most folks don't really understand or think about all the considerations that are happening during a fire, not only about what is burning, but how the fire is being fought. Jason, can you speak a little bit about this?
Yeah, so when we have wildfires across the West, each agency, state, federal, we have to comply with the different laws like the Antiquity Act, Historic Sites Act, Archaeological Resources Protection Act, and that compels us to have people on the ground able to deal with the different resource issues that come up, whether they're endangered species or cultural resources like what I deal with.
Yep.
So we're out on the ground facilitating decision-making to helping managers decide which tactics work best, what type of fire sites can handle, and whether sites should be protected or not protected. So archaeologists, we're out working with people on the ground. We're working with people at the incident command post. We're working with managers, helping them make decisions that will help protect these sites.
Because water is not the only tool for fighting fires. There's backhoes and big things that can really be destructive to the landscape, right?
Yeah, and some agencies, they use a lot of bulldozers. They can have retardant drops around traditional cultural properties, rock art panels, and we're helping gather that information to help them avoid damaging these sites, or minimizing or mitigating those suppression tactics.
And so you are often dealing with the fire is happening right now, oh my gosh, but Vicki, your work is more geared towards trying to get out in front of that with prescribed burns. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the use of prescribed burns and how they can promote healthy forests. And it's not just preventing catastrophic fires, but it's also they can be kind of managed or manipulated to encourage certain resources and for the forest just to be healthier overall.
Yeah. And honestly, I spend a lot of time on wildfire, too. And so I kind of do like all the kind of things with fire. And I think a lot of us that work in fire do, like, we do prescribed burning and we do wildfire in the summer. So it kind of is necessitates, you know, based on the conditions. So yeah, prescribed burning, we do a lot of that here locally, prescribed burning, or we also do cultural burning. And then we also do like melding the two, which is like prescribed burning with cultural objectives, which really means that we're really doing prescribed burning in a way that is really enhancing a lot of cultural plants and protecting cultural places, and doing it in a way that the community and like the tribal community here is supported by the fire, you know, burning in gathering places or burning for basket weave materials. And there is a lot of push to support the return of ceremonial fire at larger scales here for the Karuk tribe, because we do traditionally have a long history of burning for various reasons, including large-scale ceremonial purposes. So yeah, that's like a big part of the work we do is when we do land management here, you know, we're doing like supporting like brushing or thinning and prepping areas, even logging, restoration logging. But in a lot of ways, we're also really trying to prep places so that we can restore fire, whether it's cultural burning or prescribed burning, to a lot of the places here, because we live in a very fire-prone landscape here and on the Klamath River.
And when the fire is too hot, it you know, of course, we know it can damage archaeological sites and that can be permanent, but it can also really have long-lasting impacts and even generational impacts on the cultural resources you're talking about, like the basket weaving material and stuff like that. So that's got to be something that's of concern. And is that kind of how you decide where you try to proactively get in ahead of time to protect those spaces?
In a lot of ways, the work that I do here in our cultural resource department / like archaeology department, we actually really, these places that have a lot of like history, a lot of current cultural use, like ceremonial areas or like village sites, like these places are really areas we really actually want to get in and treat with fire. Mm-hmm. So we don't shy away from using fire within these places, because really intense wildfire is really way more harmful. And that's why we do work on during wildfire season. But a lot of these places, if we're able to get in and tend them actively like we traditionally would be way more fire safe in general overall. And the whole point is to like continue to use these places as tribal people, because we're, you know, a living culture. Mm-hmm. These gathering places, these basket-weaving places, these ceremonial places, we would traditionally be burning them. So a lot of the cultural like items or sites and features, we really are enhancing them and protecting them via fire. So we don't shy away from exclusion of fire unless it's a really like fire sensitive thing, like a built structure. But even then, we're really good at like protecting these kinds of places. We do it all the time around here. And it's really what we've really built our fire program around, is to create knowledge amongst everybody here about how we protect these places, because they're really some of the main places we want to use fire to protect, you know, archaeological or just general cultural community sites.
Yeah, I mean, it's so important to get out ahead of that stuff. So that's amazing, the work you're doing.
Yeah, and what we see around the world, and particularly here in the Southwest, is that our indigenous sites, our cultural resource sites, they're fire resilient. Just like indigenous people, we can handle a little bit of stress. And a lot of these sites, they burned 100 times in 1,000 years, or 1,000 times in 23,000 years. Our sites have adapted just like the environment to fire. We need fire to keep our sites healthy. We need fire to help preserve and protect these sites. Otherwise, when we get those fuel buildups that Vicky was mentioning, we get catastrophic effects. We get pottery that can melt. We have projectile points that can change into a different kind of material. We have our structures that can burn. All of that's important, but all of that also needs fire. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my role is helping people determine like, okay, this can handle it and this can't. And I think that across the country with our fire archaeology training, our resource advisor training, we're helping people realize that. And that facilitates reintroducing healthy fire back to the landscape.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we are talking about fire. And so, Jason, I want to follow up on that. Like, I know that there was the 1911 law, I think it was the Weeks Act, that stopped people from being able to burn on public lands, when did people start to just not want any fires ever, from recognizing it as a really useful tool to like, never wanting a fire ever? And I know this has got to be tied into settler colonialism, of course, but what is the big shift there in the way that those kind of, how fire becomes vilified?
Well, I think if you look way back, even the early colonists did realize that fire was healthy, mm-hmm. and they realized that the exclusion of indigenous people had led to the lack of fire. And if you read a book, Forgotten Fire by Omar Stewart, he mentions that. He analyzes a lot of early documents from colonists, from Spanish explorers, talking about how indigenous people use fire. And without fire, the landscape becomes unhealthy, unwholesome. It becomes overgrown, and animals can't live there, and animals can't thrive. So early on, they realized that fire is an important part of the landscape, but no one really... It wasn't part of the institution of, it wasn't part of management. People did it incidentally. They just did it to clear their fields. And there wasn't this massive push to keep fire on the landscape. People began to fear it. Mm-hmm. And by the time of the early 1900s, when we had the 10 o'clock rule where every fire was out, the fear became part of society. We started to view smoke. We started to view fire effects as bad. It became a national campaign. Smokey Bear is a good example of that, to put out every fire. And that's just led to the catastrophic fires we have today. And as people look back, how do we prevent these things? How do we how do we prevent communities from burning and being affected, they happen to stumble upon old literature. They happen to talk to their friends and neighbors, us Indigenous people, and we have a lot to say. It's like, you know, our ancestors, we use fire. Some of our tribes are very fire savvy. I'm from the desert. My tribe isn't at the level of the other tribes in California and Oregon, but we have this history of fire, and working together, we're finding ways to share that. We're finding ways to incorporate that. And I think in the long run, that'll help us save communities. That'll help encourage cultural burning. It'll help encourage the historical ceremonial attachments to fire and other resource tools.
Yeah.
So I think we're just getting back to that. We're moving forward by looking back, which is a lot of what archaeologists do.
Absolutely. And, you know, Vicky, the work you're doing is along those lines is really being spearheaded by women. And I think that's so rad. And it brings really important new perspectives. And I would suggest nuance to an industry that's been historically male dominated and militaristic. As part of what Jason was talking about, that shift away from fire, it also became like a battle to be fought. And, I know that language can feed into those narratives, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the way you're working to kind of decolonize people's relationship with fire by also thinking about the language and the way we talk about it.
Yeah, like the literal language that's tied with fire management is very militaristic. The fire world is really, really militaristic, and it really bleeds into prescribed burning, you know, included. So the work that we've done, we've had what we've had locally the last few years, we've had a Indigenous women's burning event. And through that event, we've really brought in feedback from community members here and from other Indigenous women, non-binary, trans, you know, inclusion of all kinds of people, but centering around this idea of like how do we burn in a way more culturally relevant way, you know, acknowledging that even prescribed burning world can be very like male dominated and very militaristic and colonial. And one of the ways that we were really looking into that, you know, we started using the language a lot more in this area, using Kudyk language. We use words like ahish to replace the words like mop up, you know, being like a very military and really having a really dark past, that term, and to replace that word, you know, with a word that really is talking about putting the fire out, you know, walking around and making sure places are cool. But that's kind of one way in which we've really like been trying to rethink and make people feel more comfortable with doing the work. Because when you're really talking in that way, it really influences the way you're feeling and doing about the work. And there's so many more terms. There's so many more like seem like small things within the fire world that are really big things and is able to make people feel comfortable out there burning. Because, yeah, speaking for our area here, the influence of like women and community and just generally being a lot more family-based is a huge part of like our Indigenous fire culture. And it's not purely like cis hetero male centric. And I think that's something that we really need to get back to here, especially when we talk about like gathering areas or basket weaving as a huge practice related to fire. Like we want to make people feel comfortable so they're able to continue that practice. And that's a lot of these traditional practices, a lot of these things that really revitalize the mental health of our community is really tied to fire. So it's all not just about fire and fire protection, but it's also really about mental health and supporting our community and making them feel comfortable and learning too.
Great. Yeah, that's
so
amazing.
I might add that when we look at fire, we look at fire management, it's just not managing resources. We're managing people. Indigenous cultures, we have a lot to contribute, not just in the actual science of burn this time of year, burn this way, but also in the way our culture has this fire society. The women know how to take care of the landscape. The women are the caretakers of this information, and men, we tend to become implementers. This is something that Western management can learn from. This is something that Western management can find ways to apply and make use of.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with more Underground History. And we're back. You're listening to Underground History. I'm Chelsea Rose, speaking with Jason Nez and Vicki Preston about cultural fire practices. So, yeah, I want to lean into that even more about the way we think about fire. Who are the knowledge holders we are listening to and should be listening to? And both of you have to navigate a complex web of, you know, bureaucracies and governments and landowners and all those kind of things. And so if all of those were set aside for a moment, you know, could you tell us a few things that, you know, specific things that you think we could be doing or should be doing that would help us reframe the way that we, you know, live with fire in our lives? Because I think we can all expect it's not going to be going away anytime soon. This is our reality.
Yeah. So I think that our society, not just American society, but society around the world, needs to realize that modern humans were fire people just as much as we are water people. All around the world, we have this long history of using fire, from Africa to Europe to North America to Asia. And it just so happens North America, we're closest to that history, and we've been able to hang on to it despite a lot of the negative things that have happened in the past. During the early colonial period, anyone that was smart was the people they got rid of, which happens to be the knowledge holders. It happened to be the people that knew the long history as told in stories and songs. Those were the first people to be removed. So someone like myself and a lot of people, we're trying to relearn these skills. We're trying to relearn it without those teachers and relearn it with minimal input. And it's this difficult journey for a lot of us, but we're getting there. And a lot of that means learning.
I was going to say, and you're working within the system. So you are changing the system from within, I hope.
Yeah, I think my presence on fires, I'm on big fires, I'm on little fires, I'm on thinning projects, I'm on prescribed fires. I think my presence there shows people that indigenous people were here, were engaged. And if we're going to be here working on these indigenous lands, we have to be a little bit respectful. And we have to think about the other people who share these resources. There's a lot of unfortunate history out there, and we have to work within those parameters. And part of working with those parameters is recognizing what happened to the past and working beyond it. Mm-hmm. When I'm out on fires, we're part of the fire tribe. We're all in yellow, we're all in green, and we're all using our modern fire system to help preserve and protect things and also manage the fire. So I think that we're making attachments, and we're taking what's working and using it, and taking what's not working and not using it as we move forward.
That's very good to hear. Vicki, what about you? What's your experience with that?
I'm just thinking about your question, and I think about a lot of, like, introducing folks to fire. We've had, you know, even local folks we've brought out, people come from out of the area, and we, you know, are introducing people to fire. I think some of the things that we discuss a lot are, like, effects of smoke, for example, and how there is a way to work with smoke. And, you know, when you prescribe fire or cultural burning, or even some instances of wildfire, you know, smoke is not necessarily as huge impact as people think. But I think that when you have extreme wildfire, smoke can be really harmful. So it's about being, like, supporting more intentional burning around, whether that's prescribed burning, cultural burning, or managed wildfire burning, to allow things to burn in a way that is going to be way less smoky. And if you exclude fire, it's going to be way more smoky later. So these are the kinds of things that it's good to have conversation around with the community and with the larger community of, like, state or national levels, is that what we've seen here, even when we're able to, on a wildfire incident, allow things to burn at low severity, the smoke impacts are just going to be way less than if we exclude fire from those areas, and it's going to burn way more intense and more smoky, and be super harmful to people and places. So I think those are a lot of things that we ask folks to consider, and just encourage folks to be supportive of prescribed burning, cultural burning, these kinds of things within their communities. I know where we live, it's very rural, so we deal with a lot more different social impacts. But in more populated areas, like when I go visit my partner's family down in the Bay Area, like, I'm often like, oh, this would be a really great time to burn this.
Yeah.
Because I could see how in the hotter times of the year, this could be a huge fire danger, all this dry grass. And it would just burn really mellow right now. And I'm sure it would be really great for this ecosystem, this meadow ecosystem, to see fire. So I think that those kinds of things I would love to converse and spread through places that are way more popular. There's way more factors. You know, the human factor is greater. The political factor is greater. But I do think that that is would take away a lot of that fear and be really great for those ecosystems, those communities, if we can build in more fire. And there are a lot of tribal communities, even in the Bay Area, who would love to also promote and see that in those places. So those the kind of things that I think of with your question.
Yeah, you're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange, where we explore little-known aspects of history in this region and beyond. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we are talking about fire, smoke, cultural landscapes, and more. Jason, you had a thought you wanted to follow up on?
No, I was just going to comment that Smokey Bear needs to be saying a little bit of smoke now means a lot less smoke later.
Yes, yes.
That's something that fire managers need to recognize. We need to have that education that Vicky's talking about. People need to learn about fire history, that this country, this continent has always burned. It's always been a tool. And in the right hands, it can save landscapes, it can save resources, and it can enhance identity.
And I think the way we think about it locally has really changed, too. I live 4 miles up a dirt road with one way in and out. And when I moved there, very fire-prone area, when we first moved there, it was like, how can we save all our stuff? And now the conversation is just, how can we get out? Just us as humans, how can we get out? So I think it's just like so scary that I'm like, yes, do all the prescribed burns. Come do all the burns. And I think a lot of the people living in rural areas that are, you know, having that terror, like as part of the season, are starting to really shift the way that we think about fire and good fire and uncontrolled fire. But I want to talk a little bit about another sometimes positive aspect of fire, which is ironically working on projects over the years. I've been there where you go in after a fire as an archaeologist, and it can actually be helpful because it can get rid of, like Vicky was saying, all the dense grass and the brush where it's really overgrown, and you can actually see the ground. And sometimes that can be really helpful when you are looking to document sites if it's not like a super hot and destructive fire. So do either of you in your worlds as resource managers, do you ever get to go out and survey after a fire and kind of see what might have popped up and have like kind of the more maybe fun part of that?
Not as much as I would like to, honestly. We've definitely noticed that. And when you, because yeah, not all wildfire is super intense, but even on intense wildfires that happens where the brush is gone and you see a lot more. And on our projects too, when we're able to like implement the burning, cultural burning, and prescribed burning, there's a lot more to be seen. And that's definitely a really cool. I do think it can be really helpful for our work. It can also really be like hard when you have the public going in to look for that stuff too, because they also know that. And I think that that's something that in wildfire incidences, sometimes we might, you know, encourage like some strategic blocking off or planting of plants in areas so that things aren't as noticeable now as they might have been less before. So it's kind of like a this and that about it. But I definitely think that it kind of encourages this where we have prescribed burning and cultural burning to burn these places and then be able to like plan and go in and be able to go back and do it. Because sometimes on a wildfire incident, we're not always able to go back in afterwards and do work because that's not part of the wildfire.
And now there's just fires all year round in some places, so you don't also get that time. What about you, Jason? Do you ever get downtime to not think about fire and just think about the cultural resources in the Grand Canyon and that area?
So part of my job here is to go out after our prescribed fires, after our thinning projects, and after our wildfires and assess what's out there. I'll do some surveys. Either I'll get a crew and we'll walk out. We'll do some gridding. We'll see what's out there. Or I'll just walk, just pick a direction and go and start taking notes on what I find. And there's so much information out there. And if you're an indigenous person, if you're someone that loves nature and history, everything out there is telling us a story, and it's all uncovered by fire. The pottery shards we find, the pueblos on the ground, the rock art panels, all of that gets uncovered by fire. I'm one of the first people to see it in 100 years, in 700 years. And I feel obligated to tell this story that's out there. So anyone that'll ask, I'll talk to grade school students, I'll talk to college students and tell them about the amazing story of survival that's out there. I'm out walking after the fire burns. I find grid gardens. I find check dams. I find pueblos. I find the whole step-by-step instructions on how to survive here at Grand Canyon and in the Southwest. And I'm very privileged to be in this position where I can learn that and I can tell it to other people. I'm interpreting the information from the past. I'm interpreting it into a language that people can understand. I'm interpreting it into English. The pottery designs, the style, the size and shapes of projectile points, it tells us what they're hunting, how they're hunting. It tells us where they're planting. It tells us what they're planting. It's all out there and speaking to us. And I get to hear it and I get to tell it to people.
Okay, now I really want to come down to the Grand Canyon and visit. Vicki, do you also get that kind of thrill and experience of being able to kind of translate these landscapes to the public? And I know for you, you also are working not just with like archaeological objects, but cultural places and spaces like gathering spaces and you know, where important materials are coming from.
Yeah, I think that the work that our department does here in general, I mean, I wish I could get out into the public even more. Luckily, what we have here at our department is what we call the PICYAB department, and they work specifically within intergenerational learning within our departmental programs of natural resources of all kinds, including fire and cultural activities, et cetera. And I definitely think that our youth here are becoming so fire educated. And it's great to see, like, they come out to burns with us. And we're just trying to, you know, build in this continuance of culture. And I think what I really look forward to is building knowledge so that we can have youth events and to have community learning from our places. Because when we're out there, when I feel really privileged to be part of, like, a survey crew or out there and we find things, I feel like so lucky. And, you know, think about like the families who are still living here and about how, you know, like, you know, my family or we're with people whose family is from this village or from this place. And it's like, you know, this is our relatives and this is their places and we're still here and we're still moving in and about them. And that's really special. And I feel really privileged to have that. And I think that the youth, you know, we want to raise the youth to be like, you're still here and there's your family. These places are still here. And I think that that's super important to teach them about fire so they can take care of those places and just encourage them to get out and think about things in that way. And I think that what I really find when I'm with the youth and with our community in general is they know a lot of this and they honestly are so humble in a lot of ways. And I really love hearing their thoughts on like the world that we're in and about the plants and about the cultural places. And I think that that's kind of where my mind goes, is really investing in that alongside of this work is super important. And it's the continuance that we're going to have moving forward.
And the removal of the Klamath dams. I mean, that must be a huge shift for the region too. I mean, do you think that'll have a change fire?
I think it will have a change on fire. And it's just a huge morale boost. You know, I've grown up with that as like a whole part of my life, you know, dam removal, fighting for dam removal. I remember the fish kill back in 2002 as a student. And some of these youth have never not known anything post, you know, during dam removal. And it's a huge thing. It's a huge morale boost. I'm so proud of the communities who never hear that have never stopped. And it's been so, I've been just in love with all of the fish and all the animals that have gone back up beyond where the dams used to be already and are already spawning and creating new life up there, returning to these areas like they never stopped. Every year they were always pushing against the dams and now they're not there. And now those salmon only moving forward will only know that river without the dams. And I think that's super amazing. And I'm super happy that came to fruition this year. It's been a long time and it is super heartwarming and the youth have gone on so many visits to see that. And I just love seeing pictures of the salmon spawning up in the areas that were beyond the dams, just like, you know, beginning of this year.
This wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.